John died August 15th at the age of 75. At the 1968 Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Julian Bond became the first African-American nominated for U.S. vice president by a major political party. But he had to withdraw his name because he was just 28 years old, 7 years too young to hold the second highest elected office. If you want to see our hour special remembering the life and legacy of Julian Bond, visit democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nirmin Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Sneed Martinez, Honey Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, Pedro Rodriguez. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Portland. The time is now 4:59 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
Looking for a career? KBOO is proud to be a co-sponsor of Oregon's 15th Annual Diversity Employment Day Career Fair. The fair will be held Wednesday, August 26th from 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Ambridge Events Center, located at 1333 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. Participants may interview with over 50 major employers who are recruiting for hundreds of positions. The career fair is sponsored by the DiversityRecruitersNetwork.org. Business attire is required and bring plenty of resumes. More information is available at citycareerfair.com or on the right-hand side of the KBOO homepage at kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Indigenous community builds a solar installation in the heart of the tar sands.
Mayor Charlie Hales unveils a new plan to address homelessness in Portland.
And President Obama declares a wildfire emergency in central Washington state.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 21st, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlin. President Obama today signed an emergency declaration and sent federal relief for wildfires raging in central Washington. The declaration gives federal authorities the power to coordinate relief efforts across 12 counties in the state. 820 firefighters are working around the clock as National Guard soldiers and firefighters from Canada and Australia are on their way to provide help. Three firefighters were killed in the wildfires yesterday.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown invoked the state's Emergency Conflagration Act last night to fight a fire in Wallowa County. The declaration lets members of the Oregon Office of the State Fire Marshal send help to local agencies. The fire is currently threatening over 100 homes on the Oregon and Washington border and spans over 12,000 acres. Wildfires in the Pacific Northwest have been burning across 875,000 acres.
The City of Portland yesterday announced a $1 million plan to provide services to people facing houselessness. Mayor Charlie Hales says the city will partner with local service groups, including the Urban League of Portland, to provide mental health care and housing placement to some of Portland's most vulnerable people. The mayor says while it is not a perfect solution, it is better than the status quo. He said, quote, "First we'll provide services for the people, then we'll address illegal campsites. Services first is the key," end quote. The plan also includes two storage sites for homeless people to store their belongings and a contact system for local residents to report, quote, behavior-based issues, end quote. To learn more, KBOO producer Alan Montesillo spoke with Israel Bayer, executive director of Street Roots.
I think the city's plan is a good step in the right direction. I think by creating a collaboration with Cascadia, it allows people experiencing mental health to be able to have access to some housing vouchers. I think that the storage facilities have been something that advocates have pushed for a long time and is great and will allow people experiencing poverty to be able to store their stuff while they're able to go to other social service agencies, look for jobs, take care of their basic quality of life. So I think it's a step in the right direction. And I don't think it in any way solves the problem. But it's something that we appreciate in the context of what's happening on the streets right now. So there's a housing crisis, and I think the mayor and the city are trying to figure out what the long-term goal is, which we all know is providing more housing for people.
One element of the plan is also includes what is described as a one-point contact system for residents who want to report what the press release calls behavior-based issues such as illegal activity or people blocking public space. What are your thoughts on that part of the plan?
I think it's either going to be a brilliant and amazing centralization of information or it's going to be a complete disaster. And I think that, you know, right now there are a lot of people that are complaining about behaviors in their neighborhood and on the sidewalks that get filtered through a lot of different places. But a lot of them go directly to the police, which creates a circumstance in which people experiencing homelessness are interfacing with police officers anytime people call to complain. And so I think that this could allow for more harm reduction if the program does what it says it's going to do and is able to do kind of some surgical, you know, on-the-fly assessment of how serious the problem might be versus just a disgruntled neighbor who may not be comfortable with something happening in an urban environment. So I think that there could be some great things come out of it. We're cautiously optimistic. I think that there could be a situation where so many complaints come in that they use that to leverage things that we don't agree with, like camp sweeps and other things like that. So I think that we're hoping that it does well, but waiting and seeing.
Thank you. Could you also describe, going back to the partnering with service providers to provide services for folks who need it, could you describe in detail what those services exactly look like? You mentioned vouchers. You mentioned, like, what kind of services should these look like in sort of detailed terms?
Well, I think that it's a collaboration with the mental health services and the police to be able to provide housing subsidies for people who are completely outside of the system. So, whether we like it or not, the police are interfacing with people on the streets on a daily basis. And I think at the end of the day, they're throwing their hands up just like everybody else, understanding that we don't have enough resources to be able to house people. I hope that nobody's civil liberties are at stake and that they can actually go in there and do some triage work to be able to provide people with housing that they need. Again, with any of these programs, they have to be monitored. I don't think that there's a good guy and a bad guy in this situation. I just think it's a very complex situation in which we're trying to be able to provide services to people on the streets, and you have to be able to try different pilot projects, and this is one. We'll see if it has any success, and if it does, we'll support that, and if not, we'll get in there and try to figure out what else might be able to be done.
How would you rate our city government's performance on helping provide services to people in poverty, to especially folks experiencing houselessness?
I think that we in Portland care about the issue of homelessness and poverty. We care about trying to be able to provide people with resources and housing. Unfortunately, we live in a world where the free market is driving people out of Portland. It's displacing middle and low-income Portlanders. There is a housing crisis that leads to people on the streets. So on one hand, we're collectively doing some amazing things, and we are getting people into housing. On the other hand, we're completely being outpaced, and when you look at it from a scale perspective, we're just getting our butts kicked. And so we need to be able to scale up, and that means providing more resources for housing, and that means pushing our local government to do more. And so when you think about how many affordable housing units we're providing on an annual basis, which is in the hundreds, and we're 40,000 short, we're, from a scale perspective, we're not able to even hit the tip of the iceberg in solving the problem. And so we need to have smart, policies that not only support controlling and regulating the market, but we also need to put more investments into affordable housing itself. So, when I talk about scale, I just mean that there are more housing units becoming available than which we're providing affordable housing, and it's obviously, with the rental increases, pushing people out of Portland.
I was speaking with Israel Bayer. He is the executive director of Street Roots. I'm Alan Montecilio with KBOO News.
An autopsy in St. Louis County revealed that an 18-year-old black man who was killed by a white police officer was shot in the back. Mansur Bal Bey was shot and killed earlier this week by two police officers in St. Louis. Police officials say that Bal Bey was armed during their confrontation. His death sparked a fresh round of protests in St. Louis. Police fired tear gas at protesters and arrested nine people. St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson says that just because Mr. Bal Bey was shot in the back does not mean he was running away. The case will be reviewed by an investigation unit within the St. Louis Police Department and by local prosecutors.
A North Carolina judge today declared a mistrial in the death of an unarmed black man at the hands of a white police officer. Police officer Randall Carrick faced manslaughter charges for shooting and killing 24-year-old Jonathan Farrell. Farrell was shot in the back at point-blank range after looking for help with his car in September of 2013. The judge declared a mistrial after the jury remained deadlocked at 8-4. City officials in Charlotte, North Carolina, agreed to pay the Farrell family $2.25 million in a civil settlement, and prosecutors have not yet decided whether to retry Carrick. Over 40 protesters stayed outside the courthouse after the mistrial. Jonathan Farrell's mother, Georgia, told reporters, quote, "We have to stop killing our children," end quote.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses, a collection of women offering quality feminist affairs programming at 6. At 7, Hard Knock Radio, news, views, and hip-hop. Tomorrow's weather, sunny with a high of 91, and Sunday the same. Today in history, in 1918, the Second Battle of the Somme in France began between the Allies and Germany. And in 1959, President Dwight Eisenhower annexed Hawaii as the 50th state. The quote of the day is from Fyodor Dostoevsky. "Man is fond of counting his troubles, but he doesn't count his joys. If he counted them up as he ought to, he would see that every lot has enough happiness provided for it."
Republican attempts to investigate Planned Parenthood in over 10 different states have turned up no evidence that the organization makes illegal profits from fetal tissue. The efforts began when an anti-abortion group called the Center for Medical Progress released a series of videos featuring Planned Parenthood officials discussing tissue donation. Republicans have seized on that footage and demanded that Planned Parenthood lose its federal funding. But the magazine Mother Jones reports that probes in Georgia, Indiana, Massachusetts, and South Dakota have revealed no evidence of wrongdoing despite costing thousands in taxpayer dollars. Fetal tissue donations is legal and a common practice in the United States, but officials in Louisiana and South Carolina vow to press on.
Native leaders and interfaith organizers are embarking on a 2,500-mile journey to unify opposition to fossil fuel exports. The seventh totem pole journey will visit communities affected by the Gateway Pacific Terminal Project before giving a totem pole to the Northern Cheyenne in Lame Deer, Montana. The journey will stop in Portland on August 24th at 5:30 p.m. at St. Philip Neri Catholic Church on Southeast 16th Avenue. KBOO producer Alan Montesilio spoke with Master Carver Jewel James of the Lummi Nation to learn more.
This year is called Sacred Obligations, and some of the interfaith community is calling it the Shared Responsibility Totem Pole Journey. But it's a 22-foot totem pole that we agreed to carve for Northern Cheyenne in Lame Deer, Montana. And right now, we have three different coal parts being developed on the West Coast here, Cherry Point in the territories of the Lummi Nation, Longview off of the coast of Washington State in the territories of the Tualatin Nation and Tulalip Tribe, and then up in the Columbia River is the Port of Morrow, where the Umatillas, Warm Springs, and the Yakima Nation, but also a lot of citizens, environmental groups, and the interfaith community have been concerned about the proposed 153 million annual tons of coal that would be shipped through their territory because of the high mercury and arsenic content and the high amount of pollution that each train load will cause in the Pacific Northwest. And so we have been working with the Tsleil-Waututh Nation in Vancouver because they've been concerned about the threat of the pipeline, Kinder Morgan pipeline, bringing tar sands oil down to the Fraser River. You know, so even though the pipelines are constructed, they're always breaking. And when you have a highly toxic pollution of tar sands oil being pumped through, they're really afraid for all the rivers, especially the Fraser River. For the Lummi people, we're very much concerned about it because we've always fished on the salmon stocks of the Fraser River. And the majority of our tribal members are Native Americans from British Columbia. You know, we have family lines on the side of the border.
So I understand this route spans about 2,500 miles. Could you describe what happens at each stop?
Yes, up in British Columbia here, we're pretty much came up to meet with the Tsleil-Waututh Nation and receive prayers, but we're also broadcasting and showing the video production from last year's journey, where we brought a totem pole from South Dakota at the Sioux Nations on up to northern Alberta. And so we'll be up here until tomorrow night. We'll return to in the early evening to the Lummi Indian Nation, where between 5 and 7 o'clock we'll have a ceremony where the Lummi Nation will officially send the totem pole off on its journey. From there, we'll go to the Tulalip Nation. They have a canoe journey going on there, and people are gathering. We'll be receiving prayers and encouragement there. Our main media event will be at Longview, where churches, environmental groups, citizens organizations, and tribes are all coming together to work together to protect the environment. We'll also have a similar organization attendance and individual attendance in Portland. A lot of the interfaith community, especially like the Universal Unitarians, have really come out and lent support.
Great. Yeah. Tell me more about the gathering here in Portland. Who will be there and where will the event be?
Portland is, we're going to be there August 24th at 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at St. Philip Neri Catholic Church. That's 2408 Southeast 16th Avenue. And the Columbia River Indian Fish Commission, which will be there. They represent the Umatilla, Warm Springs, and the Yakima Nations, non-governmental organizations that are involved in environmental protection and water protection, and interfaith, the faith-based community will be joining us there and supporting us, helping get the word out, because they're very much concerned about the proposed developments, both at Longview and Port of Morrow.
Since you began, what has changed between the first time you carved and transported a totem pole to help stop coal trains and now? What's changed between then and now?
Well, most of it's about creating public awareness so that they're participating in any environmental reviews and that they're expressing themselves both to government officials and any of the agencies that are conducting reviews. And a lot of the, what we see is there's interfaith organizations that are involved in environmental protection, and there's non-governmental or environmental organizations. And everybody kind of works off on their own. And our emphasis has been to get the tribes, the environmental groups, and the interfaith community all working together on this, and all working to generate mutual support in order to make sure that whether it's Canadian or U.S. organizations conducting the reviews on whether or not these projects could go forward, that they're fully aware that there's a large public outcry against the corporations that are proposing these developments.
Great. Thank you so much. Those are all the questions I have. Is there anything that I didn't mention that you would like our listeners to know about?
No, not well. We really hope that the churches will play an active role. You know, we know Pope Francis in May of this year came out with his statement on the need to protect the earth, and we're hoping that that's going to become our daily reflection for all of us. We all need to protect the earth.
Great. And tell me again where the event in Portland is and when?
Okay, it's going to be St. Philip Neri Catholic Church, 2408 Southeast 16th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, August 24th, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m.
That was Master Carver Jewel James of the Lummi Nation. I'm Alan Montecelio with KBOO News.
Tensions between North and South Korea have risen over the last 24 hours as North Korea issued an ultimatum and accused the South of engaging in, quote, an open act of war, unquote. Last week, South Korea began using loudspeakers to broadcast propaganda messages across the demilitarized zone. And since yesterday, the North and South have been firing artillery shells at each other over the DMZ. The United States initially suspended its joint military exercises with South Korea before quickly resuming them, adding to the tensions. While relations on the Korean Peninsula have been tense for a long time, analysts say it remains unclear whether the current conflict will escalate further.
The small Cree community of Little Buffalo, Alberta, is about to finish building an 80-panel solar center that will provide all the energy needs of their community. Little Buffalo sits in the heart of the Alberta tar sands. It was the site of one of Alberta's biggest oil pipeline spills in 2011. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke with Melina Labumkin-Massimo from Greenpeace and the Little Buffalo community about the solar project.
So the community that I come from is a small remote community in northern Alberta, which is surrounded by resource extraction like the tar sands, oil and gas, conventional logging and fracking. So we are heavily impacted by resource extraction. So the reason why we decided to do this project is to show a way forward for, you know, other First Nations, but other people in Alberta and across the country and really the world, I guess, too, that this is the type of energy production that we really need to see in the world.
Could you describe what happened in Little Buffalo on April 29th, 2011, when the Rainbow Pipeline ruptured?
Sure, yeah. So what happened in 2011 was 4.5 million liters or 28,000 barrels spilled down the corridor from a leaked oil pipeline. And it spilled into our traditional territory, into the Muskeg. And because the spill was so big and so close to the community, my family was texting me saying their eyes were burning. They couldn't breathe. They were feeling nauseous. The school had to be closed down for a week and a half. So it was quite an immense and intense experience for my family and the community. My auntie who works there, you know, they had to shut down the school. And it was a really scary process because, you know, my family was texting and saying, should pregnant women be in the community, small children? Should elders who have, you know, already compromised immune systems be in the community? So it was, responding to a spill like that and trying to ensure that my family and community was safe. It was a really eye-opening experience to, you know, the type of our lack of emergency response plans there are in place for communities that are so close to pipelines that spread all across North America.
Was there any compensation on the part of the company that owned the pipeline to your community?
There was actually finally 2 years after penalization. So the community was slapped with 3 environmental charges 2 years after the spill, which costed the company about $1.5 million. But there, from what I understand, there hasn't been compensation to the community. It's just more they were remediating and had a website going that every month they would update how the cleanup was going. Unfortunately, even when they said that they had fully remediated and cleaned up the site, we went back the year after, 15 months later, and went to the site and still found a dead zone. So we were documenting, and it wasn't, you know, as good as they made it sound on the website.
What message would you say that the building of this solar project in the heart of the Alberta tar sands, what message will this send to the Alberta and Canadian government?
Well, that we don't have time to wait, that we're going ahead without them, that communities want to see this type of a development. We have the highest solar potential in the country, and yet we utilize only 1% of our solar potential. We're having a missed opportunity. We're not addressing climate change, and we're, you know, destroying the homelands of people all across Northern Alberta. So the time is now to really take real, true action on climate change. And we have the solutions. We see them being implemented across the world. You know, we see countries like Germany with 400,000 jobs from the solar industry, that these solutions are viable and they're proven technology and they're here and now. And we need to really utilize that to see what a just transition looks like in this country.
What do you think is likely to happen to Little Buffalo and Indigenous communities like it if the tar sands are developed further?
It would wreak extreme havoc on our communities, the land, the air, the water, the environment, the climate. I mean, it's no secret that, you know, even NASA scientists and climate change scientists around the world have said we need to keep it in the ground. We need to keep the tar sands in the ground. So it's, you know, going to be extremely detrimental. We've already seen massive impacts at, you know, only extracting 3% of the tar sands. So if we continue down this road, it's going to be extremely detrimental for the people that live here and also for the climate as a whole.
That was Melina Labunkin-Massimo, a member of Greenpeace and a member of the community Little Buffalo in Alberta, Canada. And this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
Yesterday, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras called a snap election just 7 months after coming to power. In a televised address yesterday, he said that the political will that he won in January had run out. He said, quote, "The political mandate has exhausted its limits, and now the Greek people have to have their say. I want to be honest with you. We did not achieve the agreement we expected before the January elections," end quote. Tsipras is hoping to win support for his controversial bailout deal with the European Union, which includes more tax raises and cuts in public spending. His decision angered left-wing members of his own party, who helped elect him on a promise to end austerity measures. Early reports suggest that the election will take place as early as mid-September. Listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Ethan Martin, the producer is Alan Montesillo, and our engineer is Ian Gadberry. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or look for us on Twitter at KABU News. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund.
And I'm Liam Delta. Coming up Monday morning on KABU at 7, Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on More Talk Radio, Doug McVeigh speaks with Robin Singh, Executive Director of the Oregon Justice Resource Center. They'll talk about ending systematic discrimination in the justice system. At 9, the Old Mole Variety Hour, a program of social and political commentary from a socialist feminist point of view. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein will be off. Instead, we'll hear a program from TU